how can the same country that produced Tolstoy and Chekhov also do this horrible self-inflicted genocide to itself? Where does this massive kind of evil emerge from, you know, one of the most cultured, warmest, generous people on earth?
Russians Remember Stalin on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Between 1929 and 1953, Joseph Stalin was in complete control of the Soviet Union. During that time, many scholars say 20 million Russians lost their lives, and that doesn't count the carnage of World War II. Of those 20 million, perhaps 8 million died in man-made famines, and 7 million were executed. The remainder died in the prisons and camps better known as the Gulag. The massive death toll is shocking, but perhaps even more brutal is the fact that the survivors of this period were never allowed to publicly discuss, explore, and mourn this tragedy. This, of course, changed with Gorbachev and Glasnost. More freedom has opened up history for these people. Some welcome the opportunity, and others wish the past would simply go away. Our guest today is Adam Hochschild, an author who's among the first outsiders granted access to the vast Gulag archives. His latest book is titled The Unquiet Ghost, Russians Remember Stalin. As he toured the former Soviet Union conducting his research, Russians would time and again look at him and say, "Why are you so interested in this?"
It was a question that came up again and again, and people always asked it in the same tone of voice, which is, as if I were going around interviewing people who suffered from some particularly exotic form of cancer, but this cancer didn't seem to be something that ran in my own family, and why was I so obsessed by this? And people would always ask me, you know, why are you interested in this? The question even came up one time when, in order to go and look at some of the old labor camps themselves, I had to fly by helicopter in the far northeastern corner of Siberia, and sitting up in the cockpit with the helicopter pilots and trying to carry on a conversation in shouts over the noise of the jet engines roaring away overhead, one of them shouted to me, you know, "Why are you so interested in all this?" Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. One is that in this process of a country living through a terrible trauma and then not being able to talk about it for a long time, and then at last being able to speak, there is something analogous to an individual going through the same thing. If you think of a person who was horribly abused in every imaginable way as a child, just barely survived, and then grew up being forbidden to speak about it, and then in middle age lies down on a psychoanalyst's couch and at last starts to speak, it's going to be very interesting to hear the passion and fervor and trauma that finally emerge. I think there is another reason I was interested, which is that I've always been fascinated with Russia. I grew up partly among emigre Russians, an experience I described in my first book, Half the Way Home. I have always been fascinated with the question of how can the same country that produced Tolstoy and Chekhov also do this horrible self-inflicted genocide to itself? Where does this massive kind of evil emerge from, you know, one of the most cultured, warmest, generous people on earth? I think I was interested for another reason too, which is that I know that if I had been alive at the time of the Russian Revolution, I'm sure that, like progressive people, enlightened people all over the world, I would have been thoroughly in favor of it. I mean, you look at Tsarist Russia with, you know, vast gaps between rich and poor, political prisoners, Siberia, you know, the last monarchy, functioning monarchy, absolute monarchy, really, in Europe. And if there was any country, there was no country which needed a revolution more. So, like many Westerners, if I'd been alive then, I think I would have been very much in favor of the Russian Revolution. And to see something which started accompanied by the hopes and dreams of so many people all over the earth turn in such a short time into such a bloody catastrophe, there is something haunting and fascinating and intriguing about that. Furthermore, as this change happened, you know, as Russia began devouring itself, you know, starting with the great famines in the early 1930s and then this massive wave of arrests, which we refer to as the Great Purge in the late 1930s, all during this time, there were Westerners, Americans and Europeans, going to Russia, many lefty intellectuals, other people going there and bringing back reports about what was happening. The interesting thing is how radically different these reports were. Some people reported what was really happening. Others came back and said, this is paradise. You know, the socialist commonwealth has arrived. They're, you know, solving the problems which we can't solve in the West. Of course, at that time, the Western world was in the midst of the Great Depression, and, you know, many people wanted very much to believe that this wasn't necessary. Things were better elsewhere. So I became fascinated by that process of seeing and denial. And what is it that makes it possible to, you know, visit another country and either really see what's going on there with great clarity or totally deny it and bring back a report of paradise? An interesting thing to me is that the breakdown between people who saw clearly and people who denied everything and brought back the news from paradise, you know, Lincoln Steffens' famous statement that he'd seen the future and it worked after he got back from Russia. That breakdown was not entirely along left-right lines. Two of the greatest clear seers were Emma Goldman and Bertrand Russell, both of whom visited Russia right at the beginning, right after Revolution 1920. Both were appalled by everything they saw. Came back and told their friends, you know, folks, this is not what we worked for. This is not socialist democracy. Something very terrible is going on. Both were ostracized because of that. And then later on in the 1930s, two of the worst deniers were figures of the American establishment, Joseph Davies, who was ambassador at the time, Walter Duranty, who was the New York Times correspondent at the time.
What about the vice president, Henry Wallace?
Henry Wallace? Went there a couple of years later, went there in 1944 on a goodwill mission to the Soviet Union towards the end of World War II, when the Russians, of course, were our allies. And that was particularly notable because Roosevelt sent Wallace to Russia on this goodwill mission. And one of the things that the Russians wanted Wallace to see was that they had gold, because they wanted to convince the United States that all of this lend-lease material that the U.S. was sending to Russia to fight the war, the trucks and planes and whatnot that Russia was using to fight the Germans, the Russians wanted to show they had gold to pay this back. Problem was that the Russian gold mining area, which is in far northeast Siberia, this territory called Kolyma, which is just across the Bering Strait and in a little bit from Alaska, at that time was worked entirely by prisoners, millions of them, as the harshest types of mining and timbering and so forth in the Soviet Union tended to be. Wallace was taken to this area for a couple of days, shown all around, never quite understood that all of the people he was seeing at work were prisoners. So he too, you know, came back with reports of paradise and people working hard and so forth. I actually went to some of the same places that he had been to on that trip when I went to revisit that area today. And the reports of his visit kind of became a legend among prisoners there, because they knew that the Vice President of the United States was being shown around. Anybody who looked like a prisoner, you know, starving, underfed and so forth, was hidden away, put in their barracks during that period. and only the trustees, the common criminal prisoners who were fed much better and looked healthier, were allowed out in view during the time that he was there.
You already mentioned the helicopter tour of Kolyma once. Tell our listeners about the size of this helicopter, the crew, how much it cost, and how it allowed you to see some places that I take it people hadn't really been to for years, probably.
Yeah. It's funny. This, I had envisaged this as the kind of somber climax of my book, because The Unquiet Ghost is structured as a journey to Kolyma, which was, you know, the worst and most horrible point in the gulag. And along the way, I'd interviewed many people, you know, former prisoners, retired camp guards, historians, so forth. But I wanted to end up actually going to see this place that has... the word Kolyma has a kind of resonance among Russians as the part that stands for the whole, like we say Auschwitz to stand for the whole Holocaust. But when I finally got there, it was actually quite funny, as well as being tragic in what I saw. To find ruins of an actual Stalin-era labor camp, even though there were many hundreds of them at the time, to find actual ruins that are still standing is quite hard in the former Soviet Union today, because one of the chronic problems of the Soviet system was always shortage of building materials. So anytime there's any one of these old camps that's still standing near a town or city, people have gone in and stripped it of bricks and glass and metal and anything that can be carried off, and there's not much left. The only places they haven't done this is where you can't get to them by road. Well, in Kolyma, there were a number of these places that you can't get to by road, or the road's no longer maintained, you know, or it's under 20 feet of snow for most of the year. And the only way to get to it was by helicopter. So I rented a helicopter. It cost me $30 an hour when you translate translated dollars into rubles. And so I figured that, well, this would be a small helicopter, but if it gets me to the places, that's okay. Well, and I arranged this through one of these sort of shadow world new businessmen, arrangers and contractors who are coming up all over Russia right now. And I went to his house the night before. We confirmed the price. And then he said, well, my wife and I will be coming along with you on this trip. And I said, yeah, okay. How many pilots? And, you know, I said, two pilots. Well, then he said, we'd like to bring our children, too, and show them the places where all these terrible things happen in our country's history. And I said, well, all right, if there's room. And then he said, and so-and-so, who's the editor of the local newspaper, and so-and-so from the TV station would like to come. And then we have this friend, Sasha. He wants to come, too, and bring his daughter. And I said, wait a minute, I'm not paying for a larger helicopter. And then he said, well, out here we only have one size helicopter. And he said, the small ones are too fragile. So for my $30 an hour, I was getting a 22-passenger helicopter with twin jet engines and a crew of four.
Wow.
I never did figure out what the whole crew did. There were the pilot and co-pilot and a mechanic and a fourth guy who's main job seemed to be jumping out as we hovered off the ground to make sure we weren't landing in a swamp. And I got to sit up front with the two pilots, which was very exciting. And then we flew for about 8 hours that day, crisscrossing the territory and setting down three times in the ruins of these former labor camps, where everything is still standing. You know, the barbed wire is all still up, rusted, but there. The wooden guard towers at the corners of the barbed wire still standing, kind of rickety, but still there. Why they felt any need to guard people when there was nowhere to run. You'd have hundreds of miles trek across, you know, snowy mountains in 60-degree below zero weather, possibly in 24-hour-a-day darkness if you were trying to run away during the wintertime. Each camp also, even the small ones, had within it a separate set of punishment cells for people who'd violated camp regulations or whatever. So even way out in this wild lunar landscape, here would be these stone cells with double sets of bars on the windows. And of course now there's nothing there, nobody living there, all abandoned. It's very haunting. It's like finding a prison camp on the backside of the moon or something. The countryside is so desolate.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Adam Hochschild. His latest book is titled The Unquiet Ghost, Russians Remember Stalin. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
You mentioned already that you talked not just with the survivors, but with the guards, the executioners, the bureaucrats who were essential to making this system work. Did you find anything surprising from them about human nature, about these people that were sort of on the other side? Were they victims also?
Well, yes and no. It is, to me, one of the enduring mysteries of any kind of authoritarian system, you know, whether it's in the former Soviet Union or South Africa or, you know, slavery in our own history or whatever, how can people carry out the cruelties that are necessary to make the system work? One person I talked to, and this was near the city of Karaganda, where there had been a big collection of camps where prisoners were put to work mining coal. Solzhenitsyn, in fact, was in a camp near Karaganda for a long time, and one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich is set in a camp quite near there, found a retired guard, retired colonel from the prison camp system, who amazingly was quite willing to talk. I think because he was so far away from Moscow, he'd never gotten the briefing, you know, don't talk to foreigners. He said we were the first Americans he'd ever seen. My wife and son were with me, actually, the day I went to talk to him. And after we were talking for a while, he pulled out a bottle of vodka and began pouring drinks. And after a while, he was sort of missing the glass when he poured, or filling glasses that were already full. And that just made him more talkative. And finally, he brought out his photographs from when he had worked in the camp system. The strange thing was that he talked about it all as if it hadn't been a prison. He said, you know, the old days were wonderful here. You know, production was good. There was food in the shops. And the school that my children went to, we had the most wonderful teachers there. And from that school, they could graduate and go to, you know, any institute or university in Moscow or Leningrad. Spectacular school. Now, I went to see the school later that day, and it actually was a school like many in this system where, because there were so many professors and intellectuals of one sort or another among the prisoners, they would pull them out, make them school teachers at a school where the guards' children got to go to school. But of course, as he described the school, you know, he omitted that, and he talked about all the wonderful crops they grew and the food they sent to the front during the war and new breeds of cattle that they developed and so forth. Kind of sounding like a proud local party boss describing the economic achievements of his region, with no mention of the fact that people were prisoners. And then he talked about what a shock it had been to hear Khrushchev's famous secret speech in 1956 denouncing Stalin's crimes, and to have learned that, you know, there were many millions of people who were imprisoned unjustly, and that this was a terrible shock. And I think he's never quite gotten over that shock. And, you know, very much yearns for a return of the old days in the sense of order and more food on the shelves and so forth. In terms of hearing about or meeting people who had worked in the system in other ways, as camp guards and so forth, I think the most interesting case was one where I didn't actually meet the man, but I met his daughter. And this was in this town called Kolpasheva, which I wrote about in the book, where I had wanted to go because I'd very much wanted to see one place in Russia where they had uncovered one of these mass graves.
In fact, was this the place where the water had washed the underpinnings there and
that's
just
right.
Disgorged this huge mass of skeletons and bodies? And
that's right. It's really been the most spectacular and garish, in a way, of all of the mass graves from the Stalin period which have been uncovered in Russia in recent years. Kolpasheva is a very small town on the Ob River, which is one of the longest rivers in Asia, and runs through central Siberia from south to north. And this town is perched on the banks of the river, about 600 miles south of the Arctic Circle. And the Ob River, when it runs across central Siberia, like any river, like the Mississippi, the big river running across flat countryside, when it floods, it overflows its banks, it changes its course somewhat. And in 1979, the Ob, in the spring flood season, began eating away at the riverbank at Kolpasheva. And also because of the spring flood season, the ice is breaking up and coming down the river. There are chunks of ice gouging away at the riverbank too, and you really erode quite a distance in a short time. And all of a sudden, people in the town were horrified to see that out of this eroding riverbank came tumbling hundreds of skeletons. And below them, below the permafrost layer, hundreds of frozen whole corpses. And everyone immediately knew why these bodies were there, because they were underneath the site of what had been the local secret police prison in the 1930s. Well, the KGB immediately got alarmed. This was 1979 when this happened. They cordoned off the site. They tried to keep people away. But people could get close enough to see and to sometimes even recognize in the corpses that had remained frozen below the permafrost, recognize bodies of people they knew who had been arrested 40 years ago, gone into this prison, never come out. One woman reportedly recognized her husband's body. People were still wearing the clothes that they'd been arrested in. Well, at the time, the KGB cordoned off the site. They tried to dispose of all the bodies, wash them into the river, get rid of them. But it left a tremendous sense of trauma in this town. And when Glasnost came along, people were then free to, you know, they got into the local archives and they looked up the records and they found names of people who disappeared in this prison. And as soon as I heard about this town where they'd found these bodies, I really wanted to go there. I just felt I had to see it. So I went there. Quite a job getting there because it was very remote. I spoke to two people whose fathers had been buried in this mass grave. And most interesting to me, I spoke to a woman whose father had been the commander of the prison. And she had lived all her life honoring his memory, knowing that terrible things had gone on in the country during the 1930s. Everybody knew that, but being convinced that her father was innocent because he was a decent man, a kind man, a learned man, spoke English, French, and German, was a loving father to her, a lover of literature. He couldn't possibly have been involved in all this terrible stuff that happened in the country at that time. And furthermore, she was convinced that he wasn't, because he himself had been arrested. Many secret police officers themselves finally got devoured by the machine and had spent some time in prison. Now that the archives are open, they've started to find his signature on death certificates, and all these bodies are right underneath where his office was. And so in the last year or two, she has been in total agony about something that happened 50 years ago, you know, these deaths that her father was responsible for, because he clearly had to sign off on everybody who was executed in his prison. He probably didn't pull the trigger himself, but he could hear the shots. They were right underneath his office. What most intrigued me about this man, as she described him, was that he, before joining the secret police, he had been a doctor. Then he joined the secret police, which was something that often the most ardent of believers did at the time of the Russian Civil War, made his career in the secret police. Then he himself had gone to jail, as I said. And then when he'd gotten out, he couldn't get his job in the police back again, but he became a doctor again and then died of old age. So I wonder what it is in the human character that makes it possible for somebody to go from being healer to executioner to healer again. And this experience and many others made me realize that, well, the germs of all of these things are in all of us. And it's the communities that we build for ourselves, the systems that we live under, that either draw forth the executioner or draw forth the healer or draw forth some mixture of the two. But it makes me a little more humble about judging people who lived through such times, because often if you didn't participate and you didn't denounce somebody to the police or follow orders to shoot and kill them if you were a guard or whatever, you would be dead yourself. And I think the main job of anybody who cares about human rights is to try to stop things before they get to that point.
Well, we're just about out of time. I need to ask one last question, and that is there a legacy that has an impact on modern-day Russia, especially in politics?
I think there's a tremendous legacy from the Stalin period, because it's impossible to live in a society where only 40 years ago any kind of dissidence, any kind of outspokenness was immediately punishable by death. Any kind of suspicion of being against the regime in any way was punishable by death. It's impossible to live in a country like that and to really feel free of that legacy, especially if you're in the older generation. Even for people in the younger generation, but whose parents grew up with these fears or having survived the Gulag themselves, it gets very deeply ingrained into people, a sense of don't rock the boat. And I think that's why there is a direct line between that terrible legacy, which of course in milder form existed before the revolution as well. Russia was no oasis of democracy under the czars. It was a pretty harsh place then too. There's a direct line that goes straight from that to some of the kind of very nasty nationalist currents that are running around Russia today, the people who back Zhirinovsky, the population as a whole, where in a recent public opinion poll, Stalin got a higher public approval rating than Gorbachev. People feel with no heritage of democracy to build on, no heritage of feeling free to speak your mind, people feel, well, what we need is strong leadership, strong authority that'll tell us what to do. And democracy is a pretty fragile plant. It takes a long time to nurture. It takes a long time, generations where people have faith that they can speak out without being punished for it, have faith that they can organize collectively to better their conditions without being punished for it.
Our guest has been Adam Hochschild, author of The Unquiet Ghost, Russians Remember Stalin. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9433, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9433. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.